Good morning. It's 9 o'clock.
I'm Laura Kanoy. Coming up next on The Exchange, alternative cars. They're out there. Vehicles that run on electricity, propane, solar power, hydrogen, natural gas, you name it. There are almost 30,000 natural gas vehicles in America today. All of the major car companies have some type of electric car. And in New Hampshire, the state government has a federal grant to buy 30 alternative vehicles for its fleet. Supporters of these cars say given the pollution traditional automobiles create, America really has no other choice. And they say today's alternative cars can drive longer, faster, and better than ever before. But if that's so, why are there still so few alternative cars on the market? We'll find out, so stay with us for The Exchange, coming up next on New Hampshire Public Radio. Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Alternative fuel cars are nothing new. In 1897, electric taxicabs were used in New York City. But while we've heard about electric and other alternative cars for years, few Americans have ever seen one, much less driven one. We're talking about these cars today, how they operate, what the latest developments are, and when, if ever, we'll see them at our local auto dealers. We'll take your calls throughout the hour. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And joining me in the studio now are Tom Hopper. He's a professor at New Hampshire Technical Institute. He drives an electric car. Also, John Osgood. He's director of the State Office of Energy. And joining us from Monitor Radio in Boston is Peter Sherman. He's with the American Lung Association of Massachusetts. Gentlemen, thanks all of you for joining us.
Good morning, Laura.
Great pleasure.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here.
Peter, I'm going to start with you. The Lung Association has done a lot of work analyzing the different types of cars, following all the political developments. Why is this so important to you?
Well, thanks, Laura. It's really important for everyone. Cleaning up our air pollution is one of the most important things we can do to protect people's health, for our families, and for our future. Air pollution hits our kids, our grandparents, people with lung disease and heart disease the hardest. People who work or exercise outdoors get hurt bad too. Together, that's an awful lot of us. And what I'd like to do for just a second is tell you a little bit specifically about what three of the major air pollutants do. First of all, there's ozone. That's our most widespread air pollution problem in the United States. When I talk about ozone, I'm not talking about the ozone layer that protects us from ultraviolet radiation up in the atmosphere, but ground-level ozone, which is the main element in smog. Ozone is a very reactive form of oxygen, and what it'll do is burn right through your cell walls. That'll cause inflammation inside your lungs, and it can scar your airwaves. Sometimes it can cause permanent lung damage, and that'll make it harder for you to breathe for the rest of your life. Ozone makes asthma much worse. Asthma is already the leading serious chronic illness in children nationwide. It's the leading cause of school absenteeism nationwide, and it is the single highest cost disease entity in the United States today. Most of us probably know someone who uses an asthma inhaler. It's very widespread, and ozone makes it much worse. One thing about ozone is that it gets transported over a wide geographic area. It forms in the air from other pollutants which are precursors to it, and it blows downwind as it's being formed, which means that in New Hampshire you can often get much more severe ozone than you might in New York or Philadelphia where those source pollutants may be produced.
Huh. So you're saying that even though in New Hampshire we have fewer people and fewer cars and fewer cities certainly, we might have worse ozone than New York or Philly?
That's exactly right. And what's more is you can't see, smell, or taste the ozone, but it'll still come downwind and harm you. If you're a child, if you're elderly, if you have lung disease or heart disease, it'll harm you at levels way below the level that EPA is calling healthy. New Hampshire's population centers are currently in non-attainment with the Clean Air Act requirements for cleaning up ozone, especially on the coast. And just last week, the EPA started a sanction clock because there's not an adequate plan in place to clean up the ozone that's in New Hampshire.
So non-attainment means it's not clean enough for EPA standards.
That's right, and it's not being cleaned up fast enough. I'd like to talk just for a second about a couple of the other major pollutants. Particulate pollution is the stuff you can see. That's tiny bits of soot, dust, metal, or whatnot, and it's deadly. Nationwide, 64,000 people are dying prematurely per year. 50 of those are in New Hampshire, and these people are dying prematurely from lung or heart disease, and it's cutting 1 or 2 years off their life. What it is a small particles that lodge deep in your lungs and just impair your breathing and hurt you. And one that we've probably all heard of is carbon monoxide, which is another invisible, tasteless, and odorless pollutant, which poisons you by replacing the oxygen that your body needs. That can lead to sleep, coma, even death, and of course, if you fall asleep while driving, that can kill you too. The reason this is all important for cars and electric vehicles, cars, trucks, and buses that people drive are the biggest cause of air pollution that all of these problems result from. Cars cause about half of the problem. Ozone transport means that cleaning cars upwind in states like New York and Massachusetts is absolutely critical. And it's important for all of us to stop driving our filthy cars. Hmm. They're spewing deadly pollution. Public transportation and bicycling are very important alternatives, but replacing our dirty cars with clean ones is key also.
Well, Tom Hopper is with us in the studio, and he drives an electric car. We just went out actually before the show and looked at it in the parking lot. I can't describe it. It looks sort of like a
teardrop.
What's it like to drive this thing?
Well, it's really a lot of fun. And let me describe it. It's just a single-seat vehicle. That's why it does look a little bit odd. But I decided, all right, what's the minimum amount that I need to get to work? I've got to carry my bag, bring my books and my stuff for class, and then I've just got to carry myself, and that's it. And as long as I can do it out of the rain, I'm going to be pretty happy. So I built a rather minimal vehicle. It's not very large, but it's a lot of fun to drive.
When did you build this thing? A couple years ago?
Yeah, I actually started 3 years ago, Laura.
And how did you find the materials, and how did you know how to build it?
Let's see. Well, I'm an architect, actually, by training, and I know a lot about materials, and so I experimented and tried lightweight construction. It's an aluminum structure, and it has a composite body on it, so it's kind of light.
Well, Peter gave us a very compelling reason why we all need to care about electric cars, care about other types of alternative fuel vehicles, as they're called. And John Osgood, you're with the State Office of Energy, director of that office. Let's get some definitions out of the way. What is the difference, for example, between a zero-emission car, a low-emission car, and what types of fuel are we talking about?
Well, a zero-emission car is one that gives off no emissions while underway. It doesn't necessarily mean that there are no emissions in the entire fuel cycle, and that's something we're coming to appreciate. Generally, an electric car is considered the only zero-emission vehicle because all of the pollutants are emitted at the power plant, where presumably being concentrated, it's easier to focus cleanup efforts. There are various other levels, as defined by the state of California, of lower emission vehicles, all of which emit more than the so-called zero-emission vehicle. In New Hampshire, we have some legislation to start to promote, through mandates, some low-emission alternate fuel vehicles, and we have what we call the ILEV, or inherently low-emission vehicle, which is one that uses alternative fuel in a format where it won't release any evaporative emissions. And so there are various different types of stages, I should say, of emissions that vehicles can produce and can be limited to.
So zero emission is electric?
Zero emission is basically electric, generally considered electric.
Yeah, I think you've made a really good point, too. When you think about a zero electric vehicle, that really sounds marvelous, no pollution whatsoever. But then how do you charge it? How do you replenish its energy? And that really is the point. It does have to be charged. And in fact,
the battery has
that's
to be charged.
Exactly. These cars really run on a stored energy in batteries. And the batteries have got to be charged some way. And so most of the time, they're charging at a utility plant. So, of course, that means the pollution is being transferred from the tailpipe on a vehicle to a stack at a utility.
So there is some pollution involved, but as John says, it's concentrated, you can control it a little bit more.
It's easier to control it that way. Some of the circumstances we're talking about go beyond air emissions, however, and I want to make that clear. My office's perspective is not one of clean air, although, of course, we're enthusiastic about maintaining our health and so forth. And it's a critical issue to us, no question about it. But trying to get some independence of oil into the transportation sector is our major focus. Right now, we're about 99% dependent on gasoline. I ask rhetorically, if we had some sort of shutoff of oil, how would you heat your home? Well, there are any number of alternatives: wood, coal, perhaps natural gas, propane, any number of alternatives. How would you drive to work? That's where the problem lies. How would you get groceries delivered to the supermarkets? How would you get lettuces from California to our supermarkets without some other alternative fuel? And we just don't have that system available right now.
I want to ask both of you and Peter Sherman about the low-emission vehicles. What type of, John, what type of fuel are they running on? Propane?
There are all sorts of alternatives right now. Propane is probably the one with the greatest infrastructure, that is to say, the greatest facility for providing fuel in the region. Propane is a well-understood fuel. It's one that's been used for years and years. We often see forklifts running around warehouses with little silver tanks on the back. Well, that's the same fuel that you use in the gas grill or to cook on your range. Why is it used in warehouses and interior settings? Because it puts out less emissions, fewer emissions. So propane is there. It's we in this region are dependent on imports for propane. So while that provides us some measure of reduced vulnerability, it's not much. But propane does have a lot of advantages in terms of range, in terms of availability. The other most popular of the fossil fuels is natural gas. Of course, we have an abundance of natural gas in the United States as a whole. We don't have an abundance of natural gas in New Hampshire. We have it through Nashua, Manchester, Concord, up as far as Franklin and Laconia, and we have it on the seacoast, but we don't have it in the west, and we don't have it in the north. So trying to get that compressed natural gas to the market is a little bit difficult here, unless we're willing to put in and subsidize the construction of additional pipelines. There is another alternative to supplement compressed natural gas, which is liquefied natural gas. It's an energy-intensive process to take a natural gas and compress it and cool it enough so that it retains a liquid form. But it's easily transportable once it's in a liquid form, so that helps to supplement the infrastructure needs that we have with compressed natural gas. There are also the various alcohols. We can talk about methanol. We can talk about ethanol. These are abundant products, but typically expensive to make. And then we mustn't forget good old gasoline, good old petroleum. Reformulated gasoline, which we have in the eastern and southern counties here in New Hampshire, has proven to be dramatically better in reducing emissions than many people expected. Automobiles are much cleaner than they used to be, and continued technology is making progress there. So the petroleum shouldn't be written out just because it's the old standby. It has made tremendous progress.
So all these types of fuels can be used in cars to make what we call low-emission vehicles. Tom, how low are we talking?
Well, that's a relative thing because of the size of the vehicle and its weight and how well it is designed, how its aerodynamics, its rolling resistance. Now, if you have a lightweight vehicle, if it's carrying a very light load and it has very good aerodynamics, well, then it will automatically be a low-emission vehicle because it won't use much energy just to propel it. And that would even be true if it were conventional gasoline. That's exactly what's happening with electric vehicle research. They're basically making them small, lightweight, a very compact or lightweight materials in its construction. A lot of composites are being used for that technology. And then they're using very efficient motor drive systems. That's one of the nice things about an electric car, incidentally. The drives are very, very efficient. With conventional internal combustion engine is got an efficiency of about 20% at best. So 80% is going where? Lost basically in heat.
Because you're stopping and starting and changing gears and so on?
No, it's just the system efficiency of the whole thing. Once you've got the fuel in the tank, you can expect 20% of that going to the wheels to do the work. The rest of the 80% essentially is being lost in the form of heat. Heat in right out through the radiator, for example. Why do we have a radiator? It's kind of a silly question, but actually it's really true when you think about it. It's there to waste energy is really what it's doing. But with an electric vehicle, you don't need a lot of things like that. There is no radiator. There is no exhaust system. There's a lot of things that you don't need. In fact, in my electric vehicle, there's no transmission. The motor itself becomes a transmission. That's kind of elegant thing about an electric vehicle.
How does your car start up and stop? What is it like to drive the thing?
Okay. There are two pedals in the car. One's the accelerator.
Ah, it's a bicycle.
and the other is, you know what, I used bike parts when I first built this 3 years ago. But I found I had to make it more and more rugged. And so I've got, stronger parts in the car now. But there's a brake, conventional brake, that uses a disc brake just like any other good car. And the accelerator, what happens when you push that accelerator down half the distance, nothing happens. And then it starts to go. And so the whole first half travel of the pedal, nothing is taking place. And then you start to get acceleration until you get full acceleration with the pedal all the way down. Well, when you let the accelerator pedal off, it comes to that halfway point, then you start to get probably the most beautiful feature of an electric car, which is regenerative braking. And as you let the pedal off towards its full off position, the regenerative braking becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. So, I turn on the key, there's no noise. It's ready to go, but you don't hear anything. It's absolute silence. It's beautiful. And as you start, you just hear a whir of an electric motor. There's nothing reciprocating. It's nice and smooth. It's very balanced. There's no parts that want to fly apart. And it just simply is very few moving parts. It's a rotating shaft, and that's it. And the motor is designed to spin very high RPM, so it becomes the transmission, so I don't need a transmission. That's a really neat feature about it. And you can do this all the way up to turnpike speeds, so it's very comfortable that way. And then when you go into regen, we have to really talk about regeneration, because regenerative braking means that the motor instantly becomes a generator. And there's a beautiful thing that takes place right there. Energy is going back into the batteries. Instead of, again, making more heat, which is really what happens when you use your disc brakes, you're making heat and dropping out particulates, as Peter has told us, into the atmosphere. Well, with regenerative braking, it's amazingly aggressive. You can use that all the way down to a walking pace. And it's perhaps the most exciting thing about the electric car.
A question many Americans care about, how quick from 0 to 60? How long does it take you to really get from the sitting position to a cruising position?
Okay, that has to do with the horsepower of the electric motor and, again, the weight of the vehicle and the load and so forth.
Because I think there's this image of electric cars as putt-putts.
Right.
You know, golf
right,
carts.
Right. Mine is not like that. In fact, I did incredibly well in the acceleration test that we just conducted in the American Tour du Sol. And actually, I had taken a first place until I think there was one or two other cars that finally beat me. It's quite fast. I could give most internal combustion cars a good run for the money up to 50 miles an hour.
I had the opportunity to drive General Motors EV1, the successor to the Impact, which is going to be marketed. And I found that to be incredibly peppy. That was a sports car. That was exciting to drive. At the same time, I had the opportunity to drive Toyota's RAV4, RAV-4, which is a small sport utility vehicle, also electrified. It drove like an ordinary car. Now, there are various degrees of ordinary car available on the market today powered by electrics. my office shares with three electric utilities in New Hampshire a Selectria. It's a Geo Metro with the gasoline drivetrain removed and electric drivetrain installed, made right in Massachusetts. It's fun to drive, and it's sort of intermediate between a conventional automobile and a very unconventional electric car. You drive it with the full knowledge that you're driving something different and something exciting, but you can drive it routinely.
I want to invite listeners to join this discussion, and then I want to ask all three of you, Peter in Boston, the two of you here in the studio, the big question about alternative cars. If they're so great, why don't we see more of them on the market? But first, let's give out the phone number, the number for you to join us today, 1-800-892-6477. We'd like your questions and comments about alternative types of cars, be they electric, propane, natural gas, soy, whatever. Maybe you've heard of a type of car that we haven't heard about. We'd love to hear from you. 800-892-6477. I'd also like to know, would you pay more to drive a clean car? Would you pay $2,000, $3,000 more if you had the opportunity to buy one of these cleaner cars? Here's our phone number again, 800-892-6477. Peter Sherman, the big question for you, why, if these cars are so wonderful, are we not seeing more of them at our local auto dealers?
Well, that's a very good question, Laura. First of all, I just want to add one more point to what was said earlier about Selectria, which, as was mentioned, is right here in Massachusetts. And when that takes off, that's going to mean lots of jobs right here. Another great thing about Selectria is it, in the Tour de Sol race, which is an annual electric and alternative fuel vehicle race, just reached a range of 300 miles, which means that it is comparably useful to a conventional car. The reason for the question you're asking, why are there so few on the market? The fact is the auto industry and the oil industry are fighting tooth and nail against bringing them to the market, which is really unfortunate. But the way their picture is this. They're driven by short-term profits. If they're making money the old way, why should they invest in change? Our health simply doesn't enter their equation, and it's unfortunate. And it should enter their equation. The EPA recently did a very rigorous cost-benefit analysis of clean air protection, and they found that for every dollar invested in cleaning up air pollution, we gain $20 in benefits.
Peter, you said that the auto industry and the oil industry are fighting it, but also all the major auto dealers, auto companies, GM and Honda and so on, do have electric cars that they're making, some that they've even sold.
Well, that's just it. That's the great irony of the situation. Publicly, and especially when it comes to talking to the people to the government agencies trying to bring these to market, the car industry consistently says, we can't do it, we can't do it. The fact is they have the prototypes, they've been around for years, and they keep getting better. There's affordability that's necessary, we need wide availability, and it needs to be profitable if these are going to be part of a widespread solution. We need economies of scale, which is why mandates are needed to bring these to market.
I'm going to take some exception to...
Well, I've just I'd just like to finish this point, and then I'll let you go. The mandates for 2% of zero-emission vehicles to be available on the market by 1998 and 10% of them available for sale to be zero-emission vehicles by 2003 have driven the progress we've seen so far. These are government mandates saying that we know we're going to need economies of scale here, so we're going to mandate that you reach these. We're going to give you some gradual ramp-ups, 2% for 98 to 10% by 2003, but these are deadlines you're going to have to meet because our health as a society demands it. We know you can do it. We're lighting a fire behind you. Let's go.
So you think that the government has some role in, as you say, lighting a fire behind automobile companies, telling them, no, this isn't something nice that you're going to play with. You have to do this for our health's sake.
And we're benefiting from it. These prototypes we're hearing about, these cars that are on their way to market, that's happening because of these mandates.
Let's let John jump in here.
Well, I'm just concerned about this general conspiracy theory that somehow the auto industry is trying to keep these excellent vehicles out of our hands. The fact is the auto industry doesn't want to put something in our hands that is not useful to us. Electric cars are still highly limited by their range. I can give you a personal example of the kind of flexibility that we insist upon in a vehicle. I take a van, which will carry seven passengers, 300 miles, towing a boat, to a vacation lake. I could not do that in an electric car.
When you say we, you mean we as Americans in general.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. We cannot do that with an electric car. The Solectria car that I have, which I love to drive, will not allow me to drive in from Henniker, south to Manchester for a meeting, back to Concord and home again in one day. I can't do it. I have to recharge the vehicle.
Why is it?
Well, the Solectria Sunrise, again, the Solectria Sunrise.
But the Solectria Sunrise is under development, Peter, and it's not on the market. It has highly expensive battery systems.
The point is, though, that it can be done.
Coming.
It can be done, and it's been proven.
So, well, yes, it's possible to send people to the moon, but we don't do it routinely.
So you seem to be saying that the batteries, the general batteries that are out there, are not good enough yet.
Yeah, he's talking about the lead-acid batteries. And lead-acid batteries for a conventional electric car like Solectria's vehicle are going to give a range of maybe 60 miles. If it's cold weather, it's going to be even less. And if you're a very careful driver, maybe 75 miles. In my vehicle, 60 to 80 miles, depending on how I drive. That is short range for lead-acid batteries. And lead-acid batteries are, therefore, about equal to the amount of energy you have in your gas tank when your fuel gauge is saying empty. Mm. And that's frustrating for the average American. Now, what Solectria has done with the Sunrise, and I'm Peter, a very strong proponent of what Solectria is doing, too. I'm very familiar with that company. They're a very, very fine organization and very committed. The Sunrise has nickel metal hydride batteries in there and a very large capacity at that. What we don't know is what the cost of those particular batteries are today. But obvious, it's fantastic that James Worden was able to demonstrate 337 miles on a charge with a car that could carry four people. That's just really remarkable, and that is equal to what most people have in their fuel tank. So that is exciting, and it is on the edge. It's on the horizon. It's really close, but maybe just not quite there yet. The other thing about batteries, there's a lot of promise, hopefully, coming with a lithium-ion type of battery, where its power density might be in the order of four times greater than lead-acid. So everybody that is interested in electric vehicles will benefit when that technology is coming.
So as Peter and John are saying, it's coming. It's just maybe not quite here yet in a large enough form.
Right.
Gentlemen, hold on to those thoughts. We're going to take a one-minute break. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. And we invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Here's the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our 800 number is made possible by Frontier Communications. We get support from our members and from the nonprofit Downtown Concord Incorporated, presenting Downtown Concord Market Days and Summer Music Festival, July 17, 18, and 19 on Main Street. The festival, which is open to everyone, features children's activities, shopping, food, and concerts every evening at 7:30. Tomorrow on The Exchange, self-employment. Can you do it? Should you do it? We'll talk about the pros and cons of being self-employed. Join us tomorrow morning live at 9 or for our rebroadcast at 8 p.m. Again, our phone number for you to join our conversation on alternative cars today is 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're talking today about alternative cars. Joining me in the studio are John Osgood, director of the State Office of Energy, and Tom Hopper, a professor at New Hampshire Technical Institute. He works with students on electric cars and drives one himself. Joining us from Monitor Radio in Boston is Peter Sherman with the American Lung Association of Massachusetts. And also joining us on the phone now for a few minutes is Jeremy Crockford. He's with Massport, which provides public transportation in and around Boston. And Jeremy, as I understand, Massport has a fleet of more than 30 Logan Airport shuttles that run on electricity, natural gas, and soy. Is that right?
That's right. We are actually getting closer to 50 by the end of the year. All of our shuttle buses at Logan now are electric or CNG, compressed natural gas, and we also have pickup trucks which are electric operating out there. Some of the tow trucks that go out to the planes are electric or CNG. We have sedans that are used at the airport that are electric. And we have biodiesel buses, which use soy. They burn feedstocks along with low-sulfur diesel fuel.
What do you mean, feedstocks?
Well, like soy. These are organics that are produced locally at a factory in Quincy that just opened, and they operate just like regular diesel fuel, but they burn very clean.
I heard that some of the soy that you got from leftover fried food or something like that. What was that?
There's a rumor that this stuff comes from fryolators.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
There is some recycling done by this company in Quincy, which they do use some of the stuff that comes out of fryolators and isn't any good for French fries anymore. This contributes to a kind of nice smell that comes out of the back of the buses. It can smell a little bit like a French fry factory when you're standing behind one instead of like diesel fuel.
I think that's a wonderful thing. This biodiesel does not only cleans up the environment in terms of emissions, but also helps in recycling a potentially nasty byproduct of our fast food habits.
Well, it's a great thing for us. If you think about the way an airport works, especially one like Logan, which is confined to a tight area right on top of the city. You have shuttle buses. If you've been to the airport, you see them. They circle, and that's all they do all day, over to the MBTA and then around to each terminal and then back again. It's a perfect place for electric, for soy, for things like that, because you've got people standing all around. Nobody wants to be standing there in a cloud of diesel, and we're already hearing from people it smells better out here.
So that's the reason for using the airport, because it's a place where you're just constantly running around, and it's a kind of an enclosed area.
It's an enclosed area. It's a good place to test this kind of thing. We have our own people who work on vehicles who are excited about this. We have room for our own compressed natural gas filling station. We are in a project with Boston Edison right now working on the electric vehicles. And there's going to be an electric bus manufacturing plant in South Boston. The first two buses off that line are going to us next year.
Well, Jeremy, I want to thank you for joining us. And next time I smell French fries at Logan, I'll think of you.
Good.
All right. Thanks for joining us. That's Jeremy Crockford. He's with Massport. They provide public transportation in and around Boston. We're going to take your calls now. And again, I want to remind you of the phone number. It's 1-800-892-6477. If you get a busy signal, please try back. We have lots of people who want to speak to the three of you. Let's go first to Peterborough. Paul, you're on the air. Paul, go ahead.
Yes, I had a question for John Osgood. This is Paul Waterman.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Solar electric car operation. I hadn't talked to you for a few months, but we're interested, like many of the teams in New England and particularly New Hampshire, in what funding might come about in a small state with a small central government such as New Hampshire. But if you could speak to that, and particularly mention what the interest for funding might be for solar energy and battery development.
Paul, I have a quick question. Are you someone who develops electric or solar-assisted cars?
I'm similar operation, I guess, to Mr. Hopper. We have built four solar electric vehicles and like to demonstrate them to the public as part of a school education research program.
Okay, John.
Paul through Conval High School has put together a team of students who've done all sorts of innovative things in terms of putting together electric cars. They put together an electric boat with a submarine attached for research purposes. They've done some innovative things. We're very pleased that we were able to help with funding provided by oil overcharge funds, which relate to cases of oil companies apparently overcharging us all during the price control days, which ended in 1981. So we've been able to spin out that funding into some innovative projects, including Tom Hopper's vehicle here and the Conval School, Dartmouth, and Fall Mountain High School has done some exciting work.
NHTI,
New Hampshire Technical Institute.
The
yes,
Technical
thank you, Tom.
Institute is the real... the real source of pride to all of us in that the faculty and students have been able to be so competitive and so innovative in many of their projects.
What about the funding?
Well, funding goes down, especially when you're working on a fixed fund. We have made the transition from backyard sort of projects to more innovative and exciting specialized projects. I'm sure both Tom and Paul will agree that our criteria over the years has gotten increasingly stringent. and because we're pushing for new and exciting developments. And perhaps Tom could share some of those with us. For instance, the Limp Home Pack that they put together is so exciting with
what
the
was
Sun
that called?
Go. The Limp Home
That's
Package.
What I thought you said. What does that mean?
Well, that was a kind of an interesting idea. The students at New Hampshire Technical Institute have been working on electric vehicles for 8 years, and it's only a two-year school, so we get quite a changeover of students. But that actually is our great resource. There's such a variety of interesting talent that's brought to bear on that. And this year, students had a fantastic idea of being able to add a secondary pack of batteries in our vehicle called SunGo, which incidentally did incredibly well this year during the American Tour de Seoul.
The Tour de Seoul, we should say, is a race from, is it New York to Boston?
Well, this year it was New York City down to Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh, okay.
And sponsored by the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association down in Greenfield, Massachusetts. They do a terrific job, incidentally, of running that race. And in any event, SunGo has these two packs of batteries, and we have the best lead-acid batteries, and I wanted to sort of let Peter know that we could find in there. It's really the next generation of lead-acid are in there.
Good
and we
you.
Have about 11,000 watt-hour capacity in that, and about 100-mile range, Peter. But the Limp Home Pack is kind of like having that little auxiliary fuel in your gas tank, and you switch over to that, and we got another 25 miles on that pack.
So you can limp home.
So you can get back. Exactly. When you feel the battery's going soft, well, you can switch. And that worked out quite well. It was a good innovation.
Paul, good luck with your work over there in Peterborough. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
The effort on the funding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. John got the message, I hope.
Okay.
Thanks. Let's go next to Middleton, Massachusetts. And Alan, go ahead, please.
My question is about the overall efficiency and pollution of the electric vehicles. The electric vehicle is by itself a zero emissions vehicle, but the electric power comes from somewhere. If it doesn't come from hydro or sun, it comes from fuel like natural gas or oil or nuclear power. So in most cases, you just burn more fuel or pull out the rods on a reactor somewhere to charge up the batteries. And those big plants are more efficient, but there's a lot of losses going from them to the vehicles. So my question is, what is the overall efficiency and the overall pollution of the total system as compared, say, to an efficient internal combustion engine car?
It's a good question. I'm going to let Tom Hopper take it. And also, Peter, I'd like you to chime in after Tom's
sure.
done.
Okay, Alan. That really is a very good question. People think, well, you're just transporting the pollution from one pipe to the other. What's the difference? The difference has been shown in the American Tour de Seoul that NESE has conducted. The Department of Energy has been following that race very carefully, trying to find out what is the real comparison. And to make a long story short, they basically took a vehicle, it was really a new Neon that they took, and they drove the course, exact same course that everybody else did when they conducted the race. And they showed on the very first day when we left New York City and we went over to Lambertville, New Jersey, they showed that the electric car was four times better. This is the net energy comparing that to the internal combustion vehicle. Four times better, or it could go four times further. In the country or rural driving, DOE has shown that electrics are twice as good when you look at the bottom line comparing it with fossil fuel vehicles.
Peter.
Yeah, and there are some numbers that are even more encouraging than that. If you're trying to compare the emissions from a power plant that supplies the electricity for a car with a conventional gas-powered car, the Electric Power Research Institute has found that a gas-powered car will emit six times as much pollutants, as much smog, as the power plant supplying electricity. And if you go to a cleaner type of power plant, such as a natural gas power plant, the pollution could be as little as 1% as of what you would get from a gas-powered car.
Alan, thanks for that question. It's a good one. 800-892-6477. We're going to go next to Manchester. And Catherine, good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm calling from Manchester. I am a resident now of Hawaii on the Big Island. And
lucky you.
Yeah,
I was
really
thinking the same thing.
Where was I in the winter? Anyway, I'm calling to talk about a proposal, really, that I have. I've been thinking about this for a long time, living on Hawaii, watching the tourists go round and around a small island. and seeing the corral of tourist vehicles up at the airport that seem to be the same cars that go around and around the island. And I have often thought that Hawaii would be a wonderful place to establish an alternative solution to all of our car problems, and to insist that maybe the tourist car industry at least converts over to solar. We have a fledgling solar car company right there on the island called SunTerra, and I don't know if people are aware, but Hawaii has taken its last sugar harvest last fall, and there's no more sugar being harvested on any of the islands. Mm. So we have a labor force there, people that are dying to do something and need jobs. And we pay $1.80 to $1.92 for regular gas. And the cars on that island, even if they're a 10- or 15-year-old car, will still maintain a value of $3,500 to $4,000. So driving a car is expensive.
Okay.
On that island.
Well, Catherine, John Osgood seems to think that's a good idea, but only if he's allowed to do the research.
All right. I like that.
Go ahead, John.
I'm on my way.
Yes.
We, through the Northeast Alternative Vehicle Consortium, a group operating out of Boston, provided funding a year or so ago to a Newport, Rhode Island rental car firm to do a test of small electric rental cars. And it was wonderful in terms of the response from the participants, from the renters. They had these small European vehicles that they could run around the Newport area in. They were enthusiastic, even though they came back on the hook very frequently. They ran out of they exceeded their range, and they also had some mechanical problems and so forth. But the idea is one of considerable virtue and a lot of entertainment and fun to the renters, but they have to be confined to a small area. And while we think of Hawaii as being small, it really covers a major amount of territory.
Well, why couldn't you have battery stations the same way you have gas stations, where you hook up again and charge it on your card and away you go?
Fantastic idea. And yes, the vehicles, certain batteries are being designed for quick change, some of them being designed not for recharging, but to recycling back to a factory to be rebuilt. And you could theoretically have a battery service station. You would stop in, and in 5 minutes, they would slip out one pack and slip in a new one. So that there are certainly ways of getting around the range limitation. However, the infrastructure needs, the developmental needs of putting together a system like this are hugely expensive, and it has to be done on an incremental basis. Hawaii may be the place to do that.
Well, my feeling is we're already spending so much that the incentive is there to reduce. And I think that Hawaii is trying to step forward in the ecotourism world as being a place that cares about its island. So if it could be sold to the Bureau of Tourism with the support of Avis or Budget, something like that, then we could really, you know, lock hands and work together. The other thought I had, and I don't mean to tie up your station, is we have tremendous amount of rotting fruit that just falls off the vine and sits in the road. And if we could even convert to ethyl alcohol as an alternative fuel, that would be wonderful, because we do enjoy some of the cleanest air. We have no heavy industry, 3,000 miles of open ocean to California and Japan, and that's why the astronomers are there. And then the other thing we have is we have VOG, V-O-G, which comes from the volcano, which is a terrible pollutant anyway. So we have clean air, but we have natural pollutants that fire up every now and then.
Well, good ideas, Catherine. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
All righty. 800-892-6477 is our number. Going next to Canterbury. Larry, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I've had the opportunity to drive a lot of different alternative fuel vehicles, including some electric. And the one that I drove, once I was satisfied with the fact that it goes 0 to 60 fine and with recumbent braking, it slows down, et cetera, et cetera, the one thing that really struck me is something I've never heard anyone talk about is as it's going down the road, it's absolutely silent. And when the car was being brought around for me to drive, it snuck up behind me, and I had absolutely no idea it was there. this is a lot further down the road when these things are running up and down Main Street in Concord, and our pedestrians naturally have the right of way. They're not going to hear cars coming. Has anyone put any thought into the fact that pedestrians are going to be unaware a car is approaching them?
Well, I think it's important to notice for a moment that that could really be a benefit. Noise is another form of pollution that is not widely acknowledged as such, but it really is something that reduces the overall quality of life for many of us.
That's
if we can eliminate
problem.
That noise, it's a great problem to have.
You're right.
Yeah, I guess maybe 5 years after everyone's used to them, that might be true, but I'm kind of wondering, you know, even on the Jetsons, the cars that were flying through the air made noise.
Have you ever startled anybody, Tom?
No, not really. That's a lovely problem. If we can have that problem, we're really in great shape. I'm looking forward to solving that one. I'm sure we can deal with that with some kind of acoustical sound that we can make.
And automobiles, internally combusted automobiles, have become significantly quieter over the last couple of decades as well.
Mostly
and we've adapted, but I will note that General Motors fits its EV1 with a backup alarm that wakes you up with a garbage collection truck in the morning.
You know, there is one thing, Laura, that I think would be really important to try to straighten out with your listeners, and that is that a lot of people think, oh, solar car. We got to address that because they are not really solar cars in the sense that they run on just what can come from clear sunlight, even if you live in Hawaii. First, you have to start with how much energy is coming from the sun. In a square meter of sunlight, there's about 1,000 watts of energy coming on a clear day. And the best photovoltaic conversion systems are in the neighborhood of 10 to 12% efficient. I'm talking about cells that you and I could buy. Not the cells that are up on the spacecraft. There would be much higher efficiency for those. But so that means if you have, let's say, a square yard, you might have about 100 watts. Well, what does that mean in terms of work? Well, you have to imagine that 100 watts over time. So imagine 1 hour of sunlight hitting a panel, giving you 100 watt hours. Well, what does that equal to work being done? Well, that equals about, in a really efficient car like SunGo, to 1 mile. That's all.
Not much.
Not much. So it's a solar. Cars that have photovoltaics on their roofs are really solar assisted. They're really electric cars, and they run on batteries. Now, it's nice to have it. You could, of course, live in a house that's photovoltaic powered, and perhaps you can charge your batteries that way. That would be nice.
Well, with the weather we've been having lately, I'm not too thrilled with the idea of a solar car. Larry, thanks for your call this morning.
Thanks.
800-892 is our number, 1-800-892-6477. We have about 5 or 6 minutes left with Tom Hopper, John Osgood, and Peter Sherman. We're going to go next to Peterborough. Courtney, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have been designing motor control systems for many years. I am quite amazed that the industry is not approaching the problem on a basis of hybrid cars, in which a small petroleum-driven generator constantly is working, keeping the pump, the batteries charged, while the car slows down, stops at a red light, does anything. There's lots of times when the full power of a car is not being used, at which time a small hybrid engine can keep the batteries up. And I think this could extend the range tremendously. I'm particularly interested in the use of tiny turbine engines, which would operate quietly, use much coarser fuel, and are a technology which I think eventually is going to obsolete the reciprocal engine. But I just don't understand why hybrid cars are not being discussed.
Tom, the car you drive is a hybrid, and I also want to hear what Peter Sherman has to say about this.
Right, Courtney. You're absolutely right. A hybrid vehicle, I think, is a fantastic interim vehicle while we're waiting for the infrastructure to get set up for all these different ways of getting batteries changed quickly or a quick charge, and so that a hybrid can do exactly what Courtney is saying. It can increase your range. For example, this year, I have a zero-emission vehicle, which has a range of 60 to 80 miles in it, but I pulled a trailer, and in the trailer I had a very small diesel motor running a charger. This diesel happened to meet 98 standards for emission already, and I was only using 6 horsepower of this motor, and yet I could drive 45 miles an hour steady state. sometimes, now the nice thing about a hybrid where it's set up to charge, just charge the batteries, you're not using it for rapid acceleration, you're not using it for hill climbing, it just becomes a, what they call a mean horsepower provider. It provides what you're going to use on average. So that means the engine can be made very small, very compact. It might be, it could be a small turbine like Courtney is talking about. I happen to use the diesel because I know it was readily available and very efficient. And so it doesn't have to be a high horsepower engine. Therefore, it can be very small, very compact, and it can run at one speed. What that means, you can dial it in for the very best, or let's say least pollution characteristics that way.
Peter Sherman, do you think that hybrids are the way to go on our next step on this path towards zero emission cars?
Well, my feeling is that anything that moves us in the direction of less emissions is good.
Yes.
If hybrid vehicles will move us in that direction, terrific. There are also a lot of other things we should be looking at, such as fuel cells, which are zero emission technology, which is also just outstanding as a step down the road.
I think Courtney, Mercedes
thanks.
Has got a fuel cell design.
I read about that. Yeah. Courtney, I'm glad you called. Thanks.
Thank you.
We're going to go next to Concord and Christine. Go ahead, please. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi. I would like to direct a question to Jonathan Osgood. I'd like to know how it is to drive the electric car in the wintertime.
That's a great question. Heat is a problem with electric cars, especially to us up here. My first experience, my first commute, I left the house at with a cabin temperature of 14 degrees.
Ouch.
And arrived 40 minutes later at work with a cabin temperature of 18 degrees. So it does have certain limitations. Many electric cars are being fitted with fossil-fired auxiliary heaters. The one we have, one can burn diesel or kerosene in it, and that provides adequate heat. But then, of course, you do get some other emissions. They're much less. Let's not fool ourselves. They're much less than a fossil fuel-powered vehicle. But nevertheless, it's a problem. You have to about the only free lunch we have in this world is the heat off our internal combustion engine, which, as Tom points out, is wasted. Well,
in the winter, maybe it's not such a waste.
In the winter, we love it.
Christine, that's a good question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take one more call. Alex, we've got just about 2 minutes left, but I wanted to fit you in. Why don't you go ahead?
Hi. I'm enjoying the program. Thank you very much.
Good.
It's the one thing that I'm interested in that I haven't heard is about hydrogen-powered vehicles. My understanding from what little I've read and heard is that there's a lot of promise. The main emission is water. What does anyone have to say about it? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank
okay,
you.
Thanks.
Hydrogen has the potential of meeting a very large amount of our energy needs for transportation, probably within the next 2 to 3 decades. Not today. Vehicles are coming along. Many of the major auto companies, I cite, for example, BMW, Mazda, and others are working hard on storage, which is a problem with hydrogen, and on some of the components for combustion of hydrogen. But it has great potential, and it's something that research dollars are being directed towards.
And that potential is improving, too. And by the way, that hydrogen technology is the fuel cell technology that I was alluding to earlier.
Oh.
The fuel cells are getting smaller, more easily transported, and they're just getting better all the time.
Well, gentlemen, we've run out of time, and I want to thank all of you very much for coming in. I think we could have gone on for another hour.
A lot of fun, Laura.
Been
thank
fascinating.
You. Thank you. It's been an honor to be here.
Thanks. That's Peter Sherman. He's with the American Lung Association of Massachusetts. He joined us from Monitor Radio in Boston. With me in the studio, Tom Hopper, professor at New Hampshire Technical Institute, and John Osgood, director of the State Office of Energy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, self-employment. If you've ever dreamed of chucking it all and working for yourself, be sure to tune in. We'll talk about what it takes, both financially and emotionally. We'll also discuss the different federal and local tax rules for self-employed people. Join us tomorrow morning, live from 9 to 10, or for our rebroadcast at 8 p.m. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Scott McPherson is the producer, with help from Paige Wilder and Norman Michaels. The engineer is Carl Watanabe. I'm Laura Kanoy.